Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode, as always, is presented by our friends over at SeatGeek. The NBA playoffs are starting this week, the play-in tournament. Playoffs kick off over the weekend. The NHL season's winding down. The playoffs start up soon. SeatGeek has got you covered on the tickets to all of these games and more. Major League Baseball's in full swing. If you want to go to any of these sporting events, concerts, whatever it is, SeatGeek has got you covered. Download the SeatGeek app or go to SeatGeek.com. Buy some tickets to something, but before you go to checkout, little promo code box. Do me a favor, enter in the promo code Can We Please Talk. You're going to get $20 off of that first purchase. Head to SeatGeek.com or download the SeatGeek app today. Hey, everybody. Welcome into an all-new episode of the Can We Please Talk podcast. As always, I am Mike Leon.
I'm Nick Saveri.
On the program today, Iranian missiles and drones, more than 300 of them, sent towards Israel and intercepted by their defense forces. If you missed what happened over the weekend as Iran retaliated against Israel for the strike that happened a few weeks back on their embassy in Syria, we're going to be joined in just a bit by our buddy Idris Ali, Pentagon correspondent over at Reuters. He's going to help us break all of this down. Plus, in just a bit, in the second segment, Nick and I are going to discuss something very unusual that happened over the weekend. The current Speaker of the House met with the former President of the United States, and they did a joint press conference. More on why you shouldn't go talk to your former boss when you work for a current boss on the other side of the break. But before I say hello to you, Nick, I want to toss to this interview because, you know, this stuff happened over the weekend. I got a lot of text messages from folks saying, is this World War III, Mike, as if I have the ear of the Biden administration? But then again, you never know, Nick. We have gotten some texts from some folks that have said some things to us that work in the D.C. circles and spaces. So you never know who is actually listening, right? As I love to say about Don Mattingly telling Derek Jeter, always run it out. You never know who's watching. And you never know who's watching and listening to this program. And so at the beginning, at the top of the show here, I wanted to devote some coverage to this. And I had reached out to Idris to help us break this all down because there's a lot to it. There's the Iranian nuclear deal that happened under the Obama administration, that the Trump administration got rid of, that the Biden administration renegotiated. Some people don't even know what's in that deal. They don't know. And there's been talking points and buzzwords across the different channels that you may watch that have talked about this, but Idris is going to break that down. He's going to break down everything that happened in the attack a few weeks ago back in Syria, that Israel attacked Iran's consulate, killing a few of their military generals and some personnel, which led to what happened over the weekend as 300 missiles, drones in this three waves type of attack by Iran to Israel. No casualties, no actual damage. We're going to find out, was this all a show of force, muscle? What comes next? So with that, our buddy Idris Ali, when we come back after the break. Nick, today's episode is presented, as always, by our friends over at Fresh Roasted Coffee. Since 2009, their passion has always been bringing you gourmet coffees from all over the world, roasted fresh to order. I got my coffee snob here, Nick Saveri. Nick, tell these people, coffee snob it up here. Tell these people why Fresh Roasted Coffee is so good and why they're the official sponsor of Can We Please Talk?
You know, often the best cup of coffee that you're ever going to have is the one you can make from home. And you need good quality coffee to do that. And that's what Fresh Roasted Coffee offers. You know, between single origin, between blends, flavors, anything on the coffee spectrum they've got. But more importantly, and I can't stress this enough, often when you purchase coffee, you don't know where to start. I mean, there's so many different varieties, so many different opportunities, so many different things you could choose from. And Fresh Roast of Coffee just gives you a very simple questionnaire and just says, hey, figure out what your coffee cup is. Figure out what blend works for you. I've gotten some single origin recommendations, so has Mike, and that's influenced everything. And what they recommend, you can get in a Keurig cup, the way Mike takes it. You can take it in the way I do it, which is typically through a French press, or you can get it for a percolator. Whatever coffee machine you've got, they've got you covered. But more importantly, just a huge variety and a way to learn more about coffee itself.
And all of this is available at freshroastedcoffee.com on their site. One cup is all it takes to fall in love with Fresh Roasted Coffee, but you get a discount for being a listener of Can We Please Talk. Enter in the promo code Can We Please Get 20 to get 20% off your first purchase. Head to freshroastedcoffee.com today. All right, I can think of nobody better to help us break down what happened over the weekend in Israel as Iran fired over 300 Iranian missiles and drones. I was thinking about this guy over the weekend, just like all of the stuff that he covers with the Pentagon, with the Department of Defense. Nobody better to help us break it all down. Idris Ali, our buddy. Idris, Mike, and Nick, thanks for hopping back on the podcast with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, I want to get like a 30,000 foot overview because maybe some folks were not tuned in to the breaking news coverage that happened on Saturday night. We're recording this on a Sunday night. If you're listening to this on a Monday or Tuesday, thank you. So there was a bunch that happened over the weekend. There's been analysis from different folks that worked in the former administration, some folks that, you know, have worked in the defense departments and stuff like that. But can you kind of explain at a high level just kind of what happened Saturday with respect to Iran sending these missiles and drones to Israel and their defense system kind of shooting these down?
Yeah. So basically, over the past week and a half, 2 weeks, since Israel targeted senior Iranian leadership in Damascus, the question has been, how will Israel respond? And or how will Iran respond? And how will Israel defend against it? And so for the past couple of days, we've been seeing this steady drumbeat from our sources and others saying Iran's going to attack. They're moving drones. They're moving missiles within the country. And they're getting ready to attack. And so finally, on Saturday, sort of around midday, 3-ish p.m. Eastern Standard Time, so sort of later in the day in the region, Iran launches the first wave, which is sort of hundreds of drones in the direction of Israel. Those are pretty slow moving. They take hours and hours and hours to reach Israel. And what we started seeing is, you know, they're pretty visible. They're pretty slow moving. People could see them over the skies of Iraq. And we started seeing countries like the United States, the UK, armed forces, and the French, and even the Israelis start bringing them down. That was followed by some cruise missiles, which are, you know, a lot faster. They fly a bit lower. And those were the second wave. And then we saw the third wave, which were the ballistic missiles, which, you know, can reach Israel from Iran within like 12 to 15 minutes. As sort of the third wave. So essentially, we had three waves of attack, each getting progressively more serious. At the end of it, Israel and sort of the United States and other countries were able to shoot out about 99% of those. And at the end of the day, we basically had a situation where, for the first time, Iran had attacked Israel from its own territory in response to it being attacked. But there wasn't really much damage. And so sort of this worst case scenario about, you know, it could be horrifically catastrophic, people could die, didn't come true. I think there's a debate about why that was. Was it because Iran warned people ahead of time, or was it because the defenses were so good? Either way, it's a situation which, you know, if you ask me Friday night, what's sort of the best case scenario, this would be pretty close to it because, you know, frankly, no one died. And it gives Israel sort of a less of a reason to retaliate in sort of a strong manner.
Just knowing what we know about Israel's defense system, was the recent, I mean, was the recent missile strike essentially performative at best? Did Iran think that they could actually make any type of headway in terms of any show of force through this attack?
That's a good question because I think it is a debate about what the intention was. You know, the drones itself, they're just really slow. And if it was just the drones and just cruise missiles, which are, you know, faster but still pretty easy to shoot down, I think the answer would be they were just making a show of it. The ballistic missiles is where I think, these are like really fast, really sort of low flying missiles that gave people pause. I mean, there were, over 100 fired towards Israel, and you just need to get one or two through. So I think, we heard a US official say, look, the intention was for them to kill, and it's really Israel's sort of layered defense where they have fighter aircraft, they have, these Arrow 1, Arrow 2 air defense systems. They've invested a lot in making sure that they can shoot things down. And so I think at this point in time, it seems like Iran, maybe measured their response, but it wasn't so limited that there was going to be no casualties. There was a real chance if one or two got through, hit the wrong places or the right places, it could cause a lot of damage.
Andrews, let's get into the why they sent this in the first place. And I referenced it kind of at the beginning. You wrote an article a few weeks back with one of your colleagues about, the attack on the Iranian consulate over in Damascus in Syria. And you were mentioning, well, first off, why don't you take us inside your reporting on that? What happened back on April 1st in terms of the Iranian generals that were killed in this consulate, and why Iran actually fired these missiles and these drones at Israel in retaliation?
Yeah, look, I mean, for the past several years, there's sort of been this, I don't want to call it shadow war, because it's been Israel just firing missiles at Iranian and Iranian-backed groups in Syria. And so that's been going on pretty regularly. They would spot some Iranian missiles going towards the border or close to the border between Syria and Israel, and they would fire off a missile and destroy it, and they would hit targets near Damascus. What happened on sort of April 1st in Damascus was pretty different. They being Israel, struck what many people, including the Iranians, say was a diplomatic facility in or next to the Iranian embassy in Damascus. And they took out seven Iranian generals, including the most senior person who has been killed since Qasem Soleimani, who you'd remember was killed in a US drone strike a couple of years ago. And so it was a really pretty brazen attack because, for one thing, they didn't tell the United States before it happened. And so they went alone, they took the strike, broke diplomatic protocol. People would argue it was probably legally questionable, probably illegal, actually, if you ask some folks. And it was a really brazen attack because it wasn't just against Iranian generals, it was against Iranian generals in another country in a diplomatic facility. And so the guy who was killed, he was a senior general in the IRGC, one of the most senior ones, and really a significant player in the operations that Iran was carrying out in Iraq, in Syria. And it put pressure on the Iranian government, the Ayatollah, to sort of respond because, there is this image that they try to portray that it is security first, they will stand up to Israel. So they had been punched in the mouth, and really, it was a question not of when Iran would respond, it was how Iran would respond. And it just sort of, culminated in what we saw on Saturday afternoon.
So there's some worries from the Pentagon about a growing alliance that may be potentially forming, or maybe it's always been there, with regards to, because what we understand is that, essentially in Damascus, you have this attack and then there's retaliation. But there seems to be a relationship between Syria and Iran. And now obviously, we have what's going on between Iran and Israel. Should this situation continue to get worse? Is there the potential of other nations within that territory that potentially may choose to take sides?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, there was an interesting concern leading up to Saturday. It wasn't just what Iran would launch, it's what its proxies or the groups it's backed in the region would do. So, Hezbollah in Lebanon, right? You have the PMF, the Popular Mobilization Forces in Iraq and Syria, what they would do, and the Houthis in Yemen, what they would do. We saw some missiles coming from Yemen, some potentially from Iraq and Syria, but not in the same way that there was concern. So that was a huge concern for the Pentagon, what these regional proxy groups would do. And so that's still a concern. It didn't sort of bear out in the same way. What we actually saw, which I thought was quite interesting, was some of the countries that sort of came to the defense of Israel, which you might not think. So Jordan itself, which borders Israel, ended up shooting down some projectiles. It was a pretty interesting thing because Iran came out and said, warned Jordan not to do that. And so we're seeing this interesting dynamic where, countries like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, who, traditionally might not be, well, Egypt is, but Saudi Arabia traditionally not the closest in terms of relations with Israel, not really coming out and you know, supporting Iran, actually calling them out. And so we're seeing this interesting situation where a lot of countries, you know, calling Iran out, partially because they don't agree with it, and partially because they're really concerned about the spiraling. You know, the concern is, okay, Iran's attacked. Now Israel would retaliate. Does that force the Iranians to retaliate? And you could see a situation where this could spin out of control really, really fast. And so I think for the Pentagon and for the Biden administration, the concern is keeping this to a minimal level, not letting other countries get involved, you know, keeping these regional proxies to a minimum. And really, it's the aim is not, you know, some, honestly, like there was talk about this mega deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel. I think the concern now is like, how do we keep this region, you know, together rather than some sort of massive progress?
Idris, get ready to kind of laugh, but also give us a moment of literacy. You're going to know what I mean in just a second, because scrolling Twitter, obviously we follow each other on social media, X. I refuse to call it X. I'm going to call it Twitter. But you were posting some great stuff about, you know, Iran's retaliation this past weekend. And as I was checking this morning, watching the Sunday shows and scrolling through Twitter, I couldn't help but notice a tweet about the Iran nuclear deal that the Biden administration renegotiated. I want you to explain that deal first, but take a listen to who it was from. It was from Auburn men's basketball coach Bruce Pearl. That's right. You heard me right. He said on Twitter, because President Biden chose to renegotiate the Iran nuclear deal and remove sanctions on Iran, he enriched these terrorists, their proxies, and destabilized the entire Middle East. Idris, I don't want you to break down Auburn's loss to Yale in the NCAA tournament. I do want you to break down what he just said there and the Iran nuclear deal. Is this because of that? Explain what the Auburn men's basketball coach is talking about there.
I had not seen that. I'm actually going to go out right after this and see that tweet. Look, the Iran nuclear deal is a polarizing issue, right? Ever since it was negotiated by the Obama administration, which essentially put restrictions on what Iran could do for a certain period of time, in return for sanctions relief, funds that were Iranian funds, giving them back to Iran, it's been polarizing. The Trump administration tore it up, and the complaint, like you sort of mentioned, has been, oh, because of this Iran nuclear deal, Iran is now in a position to grow, to have its nuclear weapons, you know, to have cash it can use to fund its activities. The counter to that, and I think most sort of objective experts would agree, is that the Iran nuclear deal was not meant as some sort of ability to cap Iranian sort of non-nuclear capabilities. It was to cap Iran's nuclear capabilities for a certain period of time, which it did. And it probably would have done even more if it hadn't been torn up by the Trump administration. The aim was never to say, okay, this is now going to mean that Iran will never do anything bad. It was very much a very specific thing that they were trying to control, which is, you know, the desire to get nuclear weapons, which is the worst case scenario for you know, I think most people. And so I think there's some misperception about what it was, what it would have done. You know, the Obama administration officials and probably Biden administration officials would argue that if anything, it gave them other avenues to spend money on. It brought them, you know, sort of more into the fold, making them less reliant and less sort of, you know, likely to fund some of the proxy groups, invest less in sort of its military industrial complex. And so it's one of those things where, you know, I think if you look back, it's this probably would have happened regardless of the Iran nuclear deal, and it probably, frankly, would have been potentially even worse if that wasn't the case.
Just bringing us back to Gaza for a moment. What's been the assessment of the Pentagon with recently with just what we've seen with the ongoings from the IDF? And I ask this primarily because right now we're obviously in a place of a little more sympathy that other nations of the world may be lending towards Israel, despite criticism of the IDF's handling of the hostage situation with their attacks, obviously in Gaza. What's been the Pentagon's most recent views and concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I think, someone I was talking to said, the biggest loser yesterday was Gaza, not because only because, it sort of gives sympathy back to Israel, but because, there's been a lot of focus on Gaza and for a night at least, and I think that might continue for the next few days. That focuses away from Gaza completely. There are not many stories that are happening at the same level on Gaza that probably is needed. I think there's been a lot of frustration within the Pentagon about the way the Israelis have been handling their military operations. The strike on the World Central Kitchen was really, I think, just sort of the tip of the iceberg. It showed down a complete breakdown in communication. There are questions about the rules of engagement, questions about how the Israeli military, Israeli Air Force sees people in Palestine and the Palestinians. Do they see them as civilians? Do they see anyone who's, male fighting age, a sort of fair target? And so there's been a lot of concern. We saw pretty early on in the conflict, the Pentagon send senior officials who, learned lessons from America's failures in Iraq and Afghanistan, go to Israel and say, look, this is what we've learned. Do not make this mistake again. You cannot bomb your way out of this conflict. You cannot bomb an ideology away. And I think, publicly, Pentagon officials say, oh, like it's having effect. Israel's not doing some of the things. But as a whole, I think there's pretty high levels of concern about sort of the indiscriminate nature of some of the strikes that Israel is doing. And I think there was a decent amount of momentum to rein some of that in after the World Food Kitchen strike. But there was a debate about does the US and the Biden administration start conditioning aid to Israel? I think that debate is probably gone now, at least for a bit after the Iranian attack, right? It sort of changes the narrative completely. And I think, in the background, the Pentagon and the administration is going to continue telling the Israelis, like, hey, civilian casualties, you have to do a better job. Let's see if that works.
Let's see if that works. You summed it up perfectly right there. We'll be following it. And you can follow him on social media. Check out all of his articles over on Reuters.com or download the Reuters app. That's how I stay informed on all of this stuff. Sometimes I just text him as well. Idris Alif, fantastic correspondent over at Reuters. Thanks for all you do. Continued success to you, buddy. Stay safe.
Thanks for having me.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quick break from the pod. As always, we are presented by our friends over at SeatGeek. If you need tickets to the biggest concerts, shows, sporting events, you got the NBA and NHL playoffs coming up soon. SeatGeek has got you covered. Nick, did you download the SeatGeek app like I told you?
We're excited to use it because we've got obviously the Phillies starting up this season. So I'm excited to take my girls out there and just take full advantage of the perks we get as partners.
That's right. As you should, as should our audience right now. So if you're watching or listening to this, when you download the app, you put the tickets in the cart, when you hit the checkout, there's going to be a little promo code field right there. Do me a favor, enter in the promo code. Can we please talk? All one word. You're going to get $20 off that purchase. Download the SeatGeek app or go to SeatGeek.com to get your tickets today. Our thank you, as always, to our buddy Idris Ali, Pentagon correspondent over at Reuters. Does fantastic work. I'm telling you, go check out all his articles over at Reuters.com. Download the Reuters mobile app. It's one of my favorite apps to use for news because when you sign on to the app, they have this curation tool. So the way it works is you can opt into, do you want a world feed? Do you want a US news feed? Do you want business news? Blah, blah, blah. It's really, and I'm saying this more mainly because I worked in product and technology and building applications. And the Reuters app is something that I really loved because of the personalization. People want to learn their news a little bit more personalized. Like, hey, I don't want to hear about economic topics. So you can filter that out. You want to hear about foreign policy stuff. You can put that into your feed. So your feed is set up perfectly. Hey, I like this reporter. I just want this reporter's topics and articles that he or she writes on. So it's perfect. Download the app. You can check out Idris's work. Go follow him on social media. Man's got 60,000 followers and for a reason, because he does great work, as you just heard him there in the last segment. All right, Nick, I alluded to it at the beginning of the show about what I wanted to talk about here before, you know, we sign off, which was something that happened over the weekend that was incredibly interesting to me. I have never seen this happen ever in the history. I tried to go back and see when was the last time this happened. We're going to try to strip out party affiliation as best as we can, even though this happened with a current Republican Speaker of the House and the former President of the United States, who is the Republican GOP candidate for presidency in 2024 in the election coming up. The weirdest thing, they met over the weekend. They had a press conference talking about election integrity, a joint press conference. If you missed it, take a listen.
Thank you so much, Mr. President, and it's good to see you all. We're so delighted to be here with our former and future president. The National Voter Registration Act, we call it the Motor Voter Law, allows people to sign up to vote when they get a driver's license. If an individual only asserts or simply states that they are a citizen, they don't have to prove it. They can register that person to vote in a federal election. And you see, states are currently prohibited, believe it or not, the states are prohibited from asking someone to prove that they're a citizen. The federal voter registration form just has a checkbox, and if you do that, you're good. The states can't allow it. Well, we think that's a serious problem. And so what we're going to do is, the House Republicans are introducing a bill that will require proof of citizenship to vote. It seems like common sense. I'm sure all of us would agree.
All right, Nick, there's a bunch there. I want to get into the high level part. But first, I want to read you the National Voter Registration Act of 1993. Congress enacted it to enhance voting opportunities for every American, it says. Doesn't say illegals, it says American. The act has made it easier for all Americans to register to vote and to maintain their registration. The NVRA allows the Department of Justice to bring civil actions in federal court to enforce the requirements. It gives the responsibility of the Federal Election Commission, which you heard him say there, the FEC, to provide states with guidance on the act, to develop a national mail voter registration form, and to compile reports on the effectiveness of this act. An amendment in 2002 transferred the Federal Election Commission's responsibilities to the act of the Election Assistant Commission. Section 7 of this act requires states to offer voter registration opportunities at all offices that provide public assistance and offices that provide state-funded programs primarily engaged in providing services to persons with disabilities, et cetera. Section 6 of the act provides the citizens that can register to vote by mail by using mail-in forms developed by each of the states and the Election Assistance Commission. Section 8 of the act creates requirements for how states maintain voter registration lists for federal elections. The act also allows for removal of voters from registration lists when they have been convicted of a disqualifying crime or a judge mentally incapacitated. The removal of voters for non-voting or having moved can only be done through certain requirements provided in the act. So there's enforcement measures by all of this. And according to a CBS News article, it has been illegal for non-citizens to vote in federal elections for decades. As well, the Heritage Foundation, this is a database, okay, that they have. The Heritage Foundation is a conservative foundation, shows that just 25 cases of non-citizens trying to vote in federal elections happened in the last 20 years. Did you hear that correctly, Nick? 25 total people tried to illegally vote. This is not according to Mike Leon. This is not according to Nick Saveri. This is not according to Donald Trump. This is not according to Mike Johnson. This is according to the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative foundation. This database that they have shows just 25 cases of non-citizens, non-U.S. citizens, tried to vote in federal elections in the last 20 years. Federal. Okay, you know what that means, folks. That means president. I mean, you know what I'm saying? So I just want people to understand that at a high level. But I want to get your takes on this because you're the history buff on this show. I was watching this on Friday. The news networks were covering this. And the akinness is if I went to lunch with my former boss at my old job, but I still work for my current job, and I went to that lunch and I had cameras meet me there, and I did a press conference with her about all the ways I'm talking about introducing some new things to our old job and trying to get her that job back, is wild to me. Like, that's the comparison. He doesn't report to President Biden, duh, but he works with President Biden. He's working with the Biden administration. He's the speaker of the current House of Representatives, not the former. And Donald Trump is a candidate running for president. He's not the current president of the United States. I can find no other instance. And if anybody can, email us, canweplealetalkpodcast@gmail.com. I can find no other instance of a Democrat who was the Speaker of the House or a Republican who was the Speaker of the House having a joint press conference with a candidate running for the highest office in the land. I could not find an instance of that ever. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm saying I can't find it because it is wildly inappropriate to do that. You are currently working in this Congress. You're currently working with this administration. Why are you down there having a joint press conference on a topic, which, by the way, I do agree with, like, obviously we want U.S. citizens to vote in the process. That shouldn't be an issue. He's getting head nods from Nick and I on that. But I just read you the stats from the Heritage Foundation. Nick, you know what the Heritage Foundation is. 25 cases of non-citizens tried to vote in the last 20 years. That's an average. That's 1.1 person a year. One. To quote LeBron, not one, not two. One. He got to stop at one. What did you make of this? I saved this for you because I purposely did not want to tell you what we were going to do in our final segment. You heard a little bit of sound there from the speaker talking about this bill that the House is going to introduce. It's going to go nowhere. They don't have the votes. Their majority is very slim right now. It's not going to pass in the Senate. Why all of this? The spectacle of all of this. Can you disassociate R&D from this, or is it tied in? What'd you make of it all?
I mean, I think it's performative. I think it's indicative of what the House GOP continues to do, is they'll make an issue out of something and try to push forward it as a law, knowing it won't go anywhere. But you get the attention from people to show as though you're doing something. You know, what I don't understand from the speaker is, you know, there's currently a bill out there that focuses on fair elections and providing access to voters, which is the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And there's no talk of that. So what is it about Republicans that are always so worried about election integrity to try to restrict access to voting? Because another question I always have about voting access is college students. Because what Johnson was talking about in terms of making sure people have access, like are using an ID to have the ability to vote, that makes sense in terms of some form of a national ID. Fine. But if I'm a college student in another state, now I obviously have the opportunity for an absentee vote, but it doesn't seem like there's as much emphasis around, you know, other situations that we've seen in challenges of voting that is not being discussed. Once again, we come up with this boogeyman about, and I appreciate what you just shared about the Heritage Foundation's findings, you know, 25 cases. So, and then let's bear in mind also, you know, another stat ongoing is mass shootings in this country. We lead the world. You know, we're at a point now where we have had more mass shootings in this country than days completed on the calendar year. You know, we've talked about this often. So if we're worried about real threats, nothing to be said about that, but we're worried about 25 cases here of non-U.S. citizens attempting to vote. So Republicans like to play this game of drumming up a voting crisis when nothing tells us this is the issue. But I shouldn't be surprised, because this is the same person that tried to remove access to January 6th footage, you know, trying to, or no, sorry, actually it was the opposite, trying to put it out there, trying to downplay a legitimate attempt to halt or overthrow an election. Whatever you fall into on this case, that's essentially what it was on January 6th, to stop an actual election from being finalized or certified. So I struggle with this idea of election integrity when this is coming from the same person that we can't even, he and I couldn't even agree on what the purpose of January 6th was. You know, the idea of an ID, I've heard this before. I'm fine with it. I mean, look, I need an ID to get a credit card. I need an ID to try and get a driver's license.
Sign up at LA Fitness. You need an ID to sign up.
Exactly. Right. So I'm with that. My question, though, is at what point in a citizen's time in the U.S. are we providing this? You know, are we giving this at the time of a Social Security card? So, you know, shortly upon birth, you get one sent to your home, right? So, like, where is this? Passports. If you have a child, you have to go out and get that. It's not just sent to you automatically. You know, if we want to play this game about national IDs, well, then what I'll offer is the one thing that's definitive is that when you were born in this country, alongside a birth certificate, you're in your Social Security card, let's just create the national ID right there. Name is imprinted. Now, obviously, can't sign it, but it's given. You know, we never have this conversation about the point of origin. Republicans like to move the goalposts on this. Yeah, you should have an ID. Well, what if I'm not a driver? What if I don't? What if there's nothing that I need a national ID for? Now what happens? Is there an office I go to? So I'm willing to have this conversation. I'm willing to understand the point. I do understand the point. But when you're telling me that you want to take these measures for 25 individual cases of fraud, then I have to call the bluff for a moment, because I don't really think this is about election integrity. And notice the comments he said before about the number of migrants at the border. 9 million, which he says is actually close to 16. I mean, is that number being backed by anyone? I'm curious about that. But he says this, and then quickly he talks about, well, you know, Biden does this on purpose. And then we get into election integrity. So let's read the tea leaves for a minute. Is the idea then that the perception of Democrats is that Democrats want to have more people enter the United States in an effort to turn them into voters, which is hysterical, because you're telling me a bunch of Latinos or would come into the country and automatically vote Democrat. Perhaps I can introduce you all to the state of Florida.
That's right.
So, and obviously Latin vote is not monolithic, but like there's just holes I have in this case. And I'm not really comfortable with the idea that there's this spook story about, well, Democrats want more people in the country, so they want more Democratic voters. You don't know if there'll be Democratic voters in the least, but it's also, you're trying to say that your Democrats will find votes anywhere. Again, there's one party in this country that was so dissatisfied with the 2020 election that its most ardent supporters came to the Capitol building to stop the certification of the election. And that didn't come from the Democratic Party.
Right. You know, Jasmine Crockett said it on our show, instead of doing things like this, how about you actually talk about policies that would affect some of these immigrants? Maybe they'll vote for you, is something that she said to us, if you recall, a few weeks back. And remember, she represents a border state in Texas. I just thought the whole thing was, again, I go back to two parts to this. First and foremost, you're the Speaker of the House. That man is running for the office. He is not the current president. What are you doing down there doing a joint press conference? And then the second part is what the press conference is about. The press conference is about an issue that doesn't exist. And it's not me saying it. It's not Nick saying it. It's the math saying it. We got to start getting back to this math part of this. If the Heritage Foundation, folks, I want you right now, if you've never heard of the Heritage Foundation before in your entire life, go look up the Heritage Foundation and then email me if you think that they're a beacon of the Democratic Party, or if they're backed by George Soros. Go look them up and take a look. And then you will find this data that they came out with. They're the ones saying it. This is a conservative foundation, conservative think tank, whatever you want to call it. They're the ones that said this, that 25 cases in 20 years. You're making up something. Again, no one's disagreeing with the overarching premise of, yeah, you need an ID. I mean, you get a Social Security at birth. You get a number, right? You get assigned that. So you would just get a Social Security card. Why can't that pass as an ID, you know, for somebody that lived and that could put you into the voting registration system automatically when once you get of age, you know, to vote. It's so ridiculous to me. And like you said, there's already legislation that would make it easier for people to vote. We should be making the voting, you know, in November a federal holiday. I've been on board with that. Make it a week. Other countries do that. They make it a full, France makes it like a friggin' month. I mean, you might as well just do that. So that way you get all of this opportunity, because the biggest issue that Republicans and specifically the former president have said, look at what happens in California. It takes forever to count the votes. Well, A, way more people there. B, 50 different states doing 50 different things. They all do different things. It's not unified. There's a commission, but the commission, as I read before, gives guidelines. You don't have to do them. Some states do their own thing. Like they do their own thing, as we saw in the famous 2000 election with Florida having these hanging chads and you had the hole punch things. Folks, it's 50 different states doing 50 different things. I just couldn't believe when I saw that play out of a current Speaker of the House. And again, the analogy is that's not my boss anymore. I'm going to go meet my former boss, go have lunch, do a presser and talk bad about the current company I still work with and the current boss I still semi work with. So I just thought it was funny to see that. More on this bill that will come into the House, won't pass, and then won't make it to the Senate. We'll be covering all of that. We'll be looking at what happened with Iran's retaliation in Israel and the war in Gaza in the coming weeks. We'll see what unfolds with all that. Again, our thank yous to Idris Ali for coming on the program. As always, if you want to check out the video portions of our interview with Idris or other folks that have been on the show, head over to our YouTube channel, type in Can We Please Talk Podcast. We should pop right up. Audio podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, Google, Good Pods, Downcast, Pocket Cast. Subscribe, type in Can We Please Talk Podcast, hit the follow button, whatever it is. We truly appreciate it. We can't do it without each and every one of you that listens into this program. As always, I am Mike Leon.
And I'm Nick Saveri.
We'll see everybody next time.